Welcome to KISS FAQ Song Stories. In this series, we'll focus on the histories of some of KISS's best and least known songs. In this episode, Rockin' Roll All Night, originally released on KISS's Dressed to Kill album in 1975. As 1975 dawned, Casablanca Records were in trouble, so too were KISS. Hotter Than Hell had stiffed on the album charts, already dropping from its high position of 100. Other acts such as Fanny or Parliament weren't setting the charts alight either, and the label's expenses were consuming available resources to the point where Neil Bogart was borrowing money from the euphemistically named Other People, or cashing in lines of credit in Las Vegas to make payroll. Touring, too, had become a hodgepodge of dates for the group, referred to as the Dartboard Tour by the crew. They'd also lost one of their core road crew members, Moose, from the road following an special effects accident in Springfield, Illinois on December the 30th. But more importantly, they were staggering from one show to another, one headliner to another, playing theaters on their own one night, then appearing as an opener for a mid-tier headliner the next. They were continuing to pay their dues. What Neil Bogart could control, possibly in part due to his inside information coming from his then-girlfriend, who happened to be KISS's co-manager, was to pull the band from the road and shepherd them into the studio to record another album. With the group in Southern California for a trio of dates near Casablanca's headquarters in Los Angeles, there was little to lose from dumping opening dates in Denver, Salt Lake City, and Tucson. Supplanting the label's house producers, Kenny Koerner and Richie Wise, who were part of a mutiny to take KISS to another label, Neil could control the recording activities while also saving on the cost of production. However, Joyce Biowitz, the co-manager in question, suggested an equally straightforward explanation in the Behind the Mask book. She said, "Neil understood the music and arranged for them to work with producers who would give them the best sound. He got involved in choosing the material and producing Dressed to Kill because he felt he knew what he could get played on radio. He was attempting to make them a little more commercial in that way and still keep their authenticity." And that is probably a fair enough evaluation of the situation. Neil Bogart knew pop. He had been at the forefront of the bubblegum pop craze during his tenure at Buddha Records in the late 1960s. Bubblegum had been rooted in a reaction to the mainstream music direction, providing a lighter tone and content without the social dialogue or innuendo. Given the bubblegum moniker, it was seen as being targeted at a younger audience, though it certainly appealed to other demographics. In essence, it was simple, catchy, fun, formulaic, and disposable, illustrated best by songs such as Simon Says by the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. Yummy 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 by the Ohio Express. Neil's attitudes towards music and art were beneficial, albeit simplistically and indirectly observational. Paul Stanley recounted in Mike Errico's Music, Lyrics, and Life, A Field Guide for the Advancing Songwriter book, that Bogart asked them to write a song that your fans can rally behind, a song that says what you stand for and what the manifesto is. In other words, they needed an anthem, and if it were bouncy and catchy, all the better. It's not that KISS hadn't already tried such compositions, though they had perhaps not thought about intentionally creating a premeditated musical manifesto. It was the next logical step for gaining attention. Casting up-tempo songs such as Let Me Go Rock and Roll in that role had not been successful, but a song such as that was more of a rock and roll jam. And to be fair, while Let Me Go Rock and Roll was issued as a single in January 1975, its promotion seems to have been abandoned in conjunction with the plans to take the group back into the studio. KISS's debut single, Nothing to Lose, didn't sneak around the back door of innuendo to success either. A real musical manifesto took some thought. Rock and Roll All Night's roots are twofold. If one takes the deliberate misspelling of Night in the song's title, it appears a transparent homage to Slade, from whom KISS borrowed multiple elements. But the title is a mere cosmetic element than the more important musical substance. Neil proceeded to use Sly and the Family Stone's I Want to Take You Higher as an example of a manifesto. That direct catalyst was one Paul could easily relate to. Again, in the American Songwriter interview, he recalled, I had seen Sly and the Family Stone when they first started out, opening for Hendrix at the Fillmore East, and you know, Sly was a game changer. The metamorphosis of so many bands was based on them, so I went back to our hotel and I picked up my guitar. If nothing else, he had the first three words of the song's title, I Want To. I Want To What was the problem he would have to figure out. Paul also suggested in Face the Music that Neil had used Dance to the Music as an example of a definitive rally song. Either song make the point being made. However, there's a stronger parallel with this song, which was written at the behest of their record label executive Clive Davis, who wanted a more commercial song from the group, something that Bogart could easily relate to in his role. It certainly worked for Sly and CBS Records, hitting number 8 and launching their career. In other interviews, Paul has used both of the songs to illustrate the point being made. Clearly, at the time, Paul could only write from his own experience, and he didn't want to be preachy. From Sly, the answer was obvious. The Inspiration Root song had been about feeling, energy, and the transformative power of music. That was something that Paul witnessed every night from the stage. The audience getting off on the music, their visceral reaction to what was being performed by the band. Again, that was what Sly had been doing. I Want to Take You Higher wasn't a clarion call to dope up, but to get off on the music, become transcendent within the sonic glory. Paul explained to American Songwriter, I wanted to make sure that the writing was never going to be pontificating. It would be more celebrating and mirroring what I was feeling rather than telling the people what they should feel. Paul worked out the concept at the Continental Hyatt House in Los Angeles. He recalled in Face the Music, pretty quickly I came up with the chords and a few lines for the chorus. I want to rock and roll all night and party every day. I knew this was the perfect battle cry. As he summarized to American Songwriter, it was subconscious, something instinctual and insistent. The anthem became a mantra and didn't need more words. It was repetitious and incessant. It was a statement, a rock and roll chant. Paul's inspiration could easily have touched on Slade's Come On Feel the Noise. Combining pop rock stomping with melodic intent. The problem was, it wasn't a song yet. However, it was enough of a seed to take it down the hall to review with the band's other primary songwriter, Gene Simmons. According to Paul in an issue of Billboard in 2003, when I came up with the chorus for Rock and Roll All Night and Party Every Day, I knocked on Gene's door and said, I think I've got it, the so-called anthem we need. Playing the idea for Gene, Gene immediately saw the possibility of marrying Paul's piece with an incomplete idea piece of his own. Gene's Drive Me Wild was musically directly connected with Slade's Mama We're All Crazy Now, as he recounted in Behind the Mask. You drive us wild, we'll drive you crazy. Gene also recalled in Behind the Mask, it was the notion of a car as an analogy to a woman, twin orbs shining in the night, the obvious sexual references are there. The idea, if I drive a car, you drive me wild, I'll drive you crazy idea. The idea of driving wild was the double entendre of the word drive. Thematically and philosophically, the two blended easily and consistently. Gene's idea served better as the verse for Paul's chorus, and thus a Corr-Simmons-Stanley collaboration resulted. Paul felt that the song was more than just an anthem, and told Rolling Stone in 2001. When Gene had put his verse to it, I thought that it was very much what Kiss was about. He was more enthused in Face the Music, commenting, as we got to work and finished the song, I could picture people pumping their fists and singing along. The 4-4 composition was included among four songs demoed at Larrabee Studios' Studio A in Los Angeles on January the 24th and 25th, 1975. Those sessions followed 2 days of rehearsals at SIR Studio B. This session was reported in Billboard magazine on February the 15th. A 2-minute and 29-second rough of the January 29th mix of the demo was cut to acetate, with the title, I Want to Rock and Roll All Day and Party All Night. Everything you got, you keep on bending and the room gets hot. You try. Acer called in No Regrets. The first time we rehearsed Rock and Roll All Night in the studio, I knew that it was a good song. When we actually laid down the track, I had a feeling it would become something special. In the studio, the road crew assisted with claps, zipper sounds, and boosting the vocal on the gang chorus. When the band returned to New York City for the proper album sessions, the song was revisited in Studio B at Electric Lady Studios on February the 12th. The song grew in realization while retaining the appealing simplicity. There'd be minor changes to the song at that time. In terms of arrangement, the demo's first chorus was doubled to be four repetitions of the chorus line. Gene also played a different bass line, perhaps having come up with something more appropriate. Gang Chorus's character also changed, with the hand clapping and crew effects becoming less pronounced, being replaced with a bigger gang sound. Ace in No Regrets again remembered. To simulate the effect of thousands of concertgoers chanting along with the chorus, we invited our friends into the studio. It was wild. Neil and Joyce were there, leaning into a microphone. Bill O'Coyne, Peter's wife Lydia, and other people on our team all shouting along with the guys from the band. Gene also recalled in Kiss and Make Up, it had a chorus that was sung by a large group of people in the studio. Not just the four band members, but engineers, families of people from the record label. About 20 people in all. We felt the energy of it immediately. It was like those old Slade songs that we had liked when we were first starting out, but with this very accessible, middle America feel. The final change from demo to album version was a tightening of the arrangement to make the whole piece concise, with 14 repetitions of the chorus line at the end of the song reduced by a third. Studio sheets suggest that a mix was done on February the 18th, and additional recordings were completed a week later. By the time it was done, Gene has recounted that the band felt that they had a hit on their hands. Fans certainly later responded to the song, but it didn't immediately become the band's signature song, nor did it replace their earlier Let Me Go Rock and Roll as their set closer. Initially, the song seemed barely an afterthought in concert, though reviewers immediately included it as one of their best picks from the album. It wasn't surprising that it was also selected as the lead-off single from Dressed to Kill. A couple of mainstream reviews picked up on the core elements of the song, and a review in Cashbox noted, "Pounding drums and a ferocious guitar roar open this song from the group's latest album. The undulating beat and anthem-like quality of the chorus add up to a satanic hit from the onstage masters of fright rock, a monster of a song destined for top 40 acceptance." Record World followed with a similar line. "Group allows their drummer and vocals to take control of the moments as they get down to rock and roll basics with the best of them. A total 24-hour turn-on for sure." What was surprising was the band didn't immediately add the single to the live set. Instead, the album's second single, Come On and Love Me, was, along with She, which had long been part of their repertoire. Room Service soon followed, then Rock Bottom, Two Timer, and even Ladies in Waiting later on. It may be a case that the song wasn't added to the set due to it not having a guitar solo, and that Ace needed time to come up with one. In early May, the song did hit the live set. The earliest currently available recorded version is from Boston on May the 11th, introduced simply as an expression of the band's philosophy. At that time, Ace had conjured the essence of his Chuck Berry-inspired solo. Videos for both singles were filmed at the Michigan Palace in Detroit on May the 15th. The audience reaction to the song quickly shaped Paul's introductory rap, and by the end of the month he was utilizing the standard rallying call the song provided.
But it's a song that means a whole lot to us. I know it's our philosophy, and I know it's Davenport's philosophy also. It's rock and roll all night and party every day.
Ace's solo continued to develop more fully also. The single debuted on the Billboard Hot 100 chart on May the 17th at 96. It eventually scraped to number 68. It was the group's first taste of chart action for a wholly original composition in the United States. The novelty Kissin' Time had reached 83 the previous year. Casablanca's royalty statement for June the 30th indicates that nearly 13,000 copies of the single had been sold by that time. With Neil clamoring for fresh product, soon after the release of the album, plans started for a Best of Kiss Live project. It was seen as a quick and dirty remedy to fulfill Neil's demands and also give the best of the band's catalog a second chance in their natural environment. With a guitar solo, Rockin' Roll All Night was given a second chance as a single and issued in conjunction with Alive. On November the 15th, it immediately debuted at number 58 on the Billboard Singles chart, a position higher than its studio version counterpart Zenith, and in parallel with the album's success, steadily rose. It topped out at number 12 on January the 25th, 1976, appropriately in conjunction with the band's three-night stand in Detroit, making it their fourth highest charting single to date in the United States. According to Casablanca's Larry Harris, the song was never a big top 40 song. It was a much bigger FM rock song, and a staple it quickly became in its live form. Naturally, the song would remain a mainstay in the band's live set for the rest of their career, a confetti cannon crescendo to end either the main set or the encores. The song was left unmolested on double platinum, but in 1988, the song was given full abuse for smashes, thrashes, and hits. Whatever thought process led to the decision to attempt to update the sonics of the Kiss classics, in the unique case of their anthem, the vandalism started by going backward. The basis for the smashed version is the January 1975 Larrabee recording, though with Peter Criss's original drum track being replaced by some percussive abomination. Gene's original bass line and the music were preserved, and it was the former that provided the first hint to the keen-eared fan that a different recording was being used. Vocally, the track is affected in some way, or its clarity is simply a matter of being unable to compare with a pristine copy of that 1975 demo. The road crew hand clapping is also either removed or mixed down into oblivion. The full repetition of the chorus at the song's end, originally recorded in 1975, are used to stretch the song out to a more 1980s duration. Similarly, the 1994 cover for the Kiss My Ass tribute by Toad the Wet Sprocket was a brave acoustic deviation from the expected with its countrified vibe.
You show us everything you got. Keep on dancing and the moon gets hot. You drive us wild.
Vocalist Glenn Phillips explained to Advance Local's Matt Wake in 2013, "We knew that no matter what we did, there would be some Kiss fans who would think it was hilarious and some Kiss fans who would be upset a band as non-rock as us was taking that song. So we decided we'd turn it into a waltz and do like a really silly campfire version of it. The thing was, Gene Simmons loved it. He thought it was the bravest thing we could have done with it. There were also a lot of Kiss fans who wanted to take a hit out on us and were very upset, but we had a great time doing it, and it actually makes a great campfire song." On MTV Unplugged in 1996, the song featured the then lineup plus Ace and Peter. The recording was issued as a single promotionally in the United States, reaching number 13 on Billboard's Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. The recording from the Turgid original Alive 4 concept was included on the Kiss box set in 2001, and then the renamed Alive Millennium concert released in 2006 as part of the Kiss Alive 1975-2000 collection. Not surprisingly, the song was given the orchestral treatment as part of Kiss Symphony in 2003. Re-recorded again in 2007, the Electric Lady arrangement was retained with only two minor lyrical changes. Like the original, the recording didn't feature a guitar solo. In the United Kingdom, the song was certified silver on April the 29th, 2022, for single paid streams of 200,000 units. Most fittingly, the song was the final one performed live by the group at their final show on December the 3rd, 2023.
The end of this road is the beginning of another road.